Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I am joined by Mr. John Syracusa. Hello, John. For a moment, I forgot your last name. How are you, John?
I'm glad you could remember it, and I'm excited to talk about our butts.
See, you're a pro. So recently, fans of John probably know a whole lot about John because of his various internet activities. That sounds creepy combined with the previous sentence. But recently, John had a colonoscopy, or at least talked about it on his podcast with Merlin Man for the first time. And I also, because we are both of a certain age, just recently had my first colonoscopy. And I was going to say, I don't know about you, John, but I do know because I listened to that episode that you were, apprehensive, perhaps, about the whole process as it approached.
I sure was, because I had never had one done. I'm generally in good health and don't have a lot of medical procedures, and this seemed like a particularly not fun one. But as with most of these things, like, I mean, if you're lucky enough to have the normal experience, which is what I think it had, it's fine. It's not a big deal. You can listen to me talk about it on a whole episode of the show. And so now for my next one, which is scheduled to be 5 years from now, I'm not really dreading it as much because I kind of know what I'm in for. And obviously with any medical procedure, things can go wrong or whatever, but I'd much rather know what's going on up there. Like, there's a reason people our age are supposed to get screened, because they found that screening at this age produces better outcomes in terms of finding things early. And finding things like cancer early is way, way better than finding them late. So,
very true.
I heartily endorse the procedure.
As do I, and I know people are listening and saying, this is not Star Trek, but I will tell you, one episode of my podcast featured my lovely mother, Joan McNulty, and I will have a link to it. She sadly died of colon cancer, which is, you know, it's not a nice way to die. There are very few, I think, nice ways to die. But a simple procedure, colonoscopy, it's not scary. There's a little bit of preparation. The preparation, I didn't even find it all that difficult a difficult experience. I mean, it's a lot of time on the toilet, but it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. So if you are of a certain age and you have been avoiding / dreading your colonoscopy, take it from two random people on the internet. It's not that bad, and it is a good thing to do, and you should do it. So now that we have that out of the way, the important public service announcement that I wanted to give people.
This episode brought to you by Butts.
Always. That's our constant sponsor. I was going to say something about going to a domain, but I don't want to make up a butt-related domain because who knows what's there.
Boldly go, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to do that. But now we've got all that out of the way. Now, besides being a colonoscopy enthusiast, John, what you want to tell people a little bit about yourself? I imagine most people who listen to this probably are aware of your oeuvre, but...
Yeah, until very recently, I would have said that I am a programmer, but I did that for 25 years, and I recently hung up my programming hat, sort of, to do what I had been doing on the side for almost 25 years, which is podcasting. So now I'm a full-time podcaster. I also still program. I have some Mac apps that I dabble with, and I, write the software that runs my own website and stuff like that. So I'm still kind of doing all the same things. It's just that no one's paying me to do the programming anymore unless you buy my apps. They're cheap. Buy one.
Buy some apps.
But otherwise, I'm just a podcaster, which is not, again, not a change for me because I've been podcasting for many, many years now, and I continue to do so. Here I am now, podcasting.
I know. It's crazy. You continue. Who would have thought that being a podcaster would be a career choice that people could make? Many people.
Can't stop, won't stop.
You shouldn't stop, please. The people demand it. They want more podcasts from you, John. And now that you're a full-time podcaster, I can only assume that you will increase your output exponentially, much like a strange amoeba from another dimension. See what I did there? That is what we call a segue to talk about what episode.
But I'm going to sabotage your segue.
Oh, no.
By saying that, no, I didn't, as I talked about on one of my podcasts, what I didn't do with all my new free time was just immediately fill it with an expansion of the other activities that I was doing.
It's 'cause you're
part
smart.
Of the point of going independent was not to be doing two full-time jobs constantly, but instead to actually have more time for sleep, exercise, taking care of myself, taking care of other people and my family, fixing things around the house, and so on and so forth. So although I am doing slightly more podcasting, Okay. I have not doubled the amount of podcasting because that was the whole point of going independent. But anyway, let's talk about Star Trek.
This is another public service announcement there. Work-life balance, people. Just because you have, you don't have to fill all your free time with hustles, as the kids say. You don't need all the hustling. You can have time to, you know, meander. That's good. Okay, that's enough of that. People hopefully have already learned two valuable lessons that they can take with them for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And now we're going to talk about a valuable episode of the original series, which is an episode I had no memory of as I started watching. Nor did I have a memory of it after I finished watching it. I remember what happened. I have no memory of watching it before the first time that I watched it previously. Now I will just stop word salading and say it's the Immunity Syndrome, season 2, episode 19 or 18, depending on what streaming service you're looking at, of the original series, originally broadcast, first aired January 19th, 1968. So this is an old episode.
And I have to say, given the nerdiness of Star Trek fans and the whole Big Memory Alpha website, I thought Star Trek folks had their acts together. But the idea that this thing is listed as episode 18 some places and 19 other places, come on, Star Trek folks. Like, decide what the numbering is. There should be an official canonical numbering. There should not be disagreements about this stuff. I'm very disappointed.
Oh, no. And I still don't understand why it is labeled, or maybe not mislabeled, but misnumbered or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, one of the numbers is wrong. Like I've said, the whole point of canonical numbering is you decide. Like, that's whatever. True. Like you said, it's because of the pilot, whether you count the pilot or not. Well, whatever. Fine. Make a decision, though. It should be uniform. Very disappointing.
I agree with you. I'm disappointed in the world. But let's talk about the original series. So you've been on Random Trek before. We talked about Deep Space Nine. I forget which other.
I think I had two Deep Space Nines.
I think you
maybe
did.
Maybe three. I don't know. It's just all Deep Space
all
Nine.
Deep Space Nine. So we probably did not talk about the original series because we weren't talking about the original series. So do you have any? Now, you hadn't seen any Deep Space Nine, I think, before I made you watch an episode of Deep Space Nine. Can you say the same for the original series? Have you seen any original series before this episode?
Yeah, you know, if you had asked me way back when, I would have said, I've probably seen all the original series because it was in reruns when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I watched it because it was on and you had no choice. And, it was, you know, and it was vaguely, you know, I was a Star Wars person. Still, I'm a Star Wars person. But, you know, I like sci-fi. But like you, when I saw this episode, I'm like, if I have ever seen this episode, I have no memory of it. I mean, I guess there's way more TOS episodes than I can remember. And especially when you're watching it in reruns, it's not like I was, you know, watching it on a schedule religiously, just watch it. It was just like, well, you know, you're flipping the channels, this is Star Trek, you watch it, right? So they were just all out of order, all jumbled across many, many years. And so I just assumed that I'd probably covered, you know, I certainly had hit the highlights of the original series and seen a couple of famous episodes multiple times. But if I saw this one, I have no idea.
And I don't know if I would call this a highlight of the original series. Yeah. I don't think it's awful, but it does. These episodes are long, John. I don't know if you got that, but I was like, oh boy, this is, it was a different time in the 60s, and they had a lot of time to fill, apparently.
I didn't find it too long. I thought, I mean, I understand what you mean. Like, it's paced a little bit slow, but I think, we'll get into it as we talk about the plot, but I think this is, I don't know if it's an important prototype, because I'm sure there's a lot of episodes that follow this formula, but I feel like this is an early manifestation of what would become an extremely common Star Trek formula episode.
Yes, they come across some strange phenomenon and there's a ticking clock and they need to pull together as a team and there's arguments over self-sacrifice.
Yeah, and they're on a ship. It's a ship episode. They're not going down to a planet. They're not, you know, interacting with it. It's like you drive around and there's a weird thing and you drive up to it and you deal with it. And it's mysterious, and it's, you know, it's, I guess it's an episode where you save money because you just basically have them on all their pre-existing sets, and you get to look at the view screen, and that's about it. Like, no away teams. I guess there was the shuttle stuff in this one, but, like, that is a tried-and-true formula, and seeing this is like, wow, it's like the prehistoric version of a formula that would be much further refined and enhanced in later decades.
So you got a budget. You got to stay to the budget. And I should have. There is a wonderful series of books called These Are the Voyages. There are three books that cover the three seasons of the original series. And they break it down episode by episode. And they talk about kind of the goings on and kind of give context about around the production and how this episode came to be. I should have went back and read this chapter, but I didn't. So maybe I'll do that after we finish talking. But the one thing I really love about this episode is the beginning when they are off to, what is it, Starbase 6 for a little R&R because they've been doing whatever it is they need to do. And Spock has this basically, this psychic episode where he feels, you know, 400 Vulcans dying as if they
millions of voices were crying out and were suddenly silenced, something like that.
But only 400 of them. and nobody seems to care. And
just Vulcans.
Like, who cares? We are tired. We want to go to the starbase.
I think they call that a Vulcan goodbye.
they apparently do. I also love this is the episode that established the fact that there are entire ships in Starfleet that are segregated by species. I think it's mostly just Vulcans because this is comes up again in other series, and one assumes it's based on this. But there's the USS Intrepid crewed entirely by Vulcans because Vulcans don't want to be around humans, apparently. Vulcans are, as we all know, space racists. But so is Dr. McCoy, as we could talk about in this episode as well. Another thing that this episode firmly established, although I think that was established before. But anyway, so they're going, they want to go on R&R. Spock feels 400 people dying, and everyone's like, eh, whatever. They get a hail from the starbase that says, hey, Kirk, you got to go. You know, check out this ship is not reporting in, and we haven't heard from the planet they were going to investigate. And Kirk is like, ugh, really? Do I have to? I don't want to. We're tired.
Oh, that was one of my questions. So, this opens up, you know, there's the continuity in TOS is, you know, somewhat minimal. But this thing opens up, it's like, oh, we just finished with an exhausting mission or whatever. Did they finish with an exhausting mission? Was the previous episode a particularly strenuous outing for them? Or is this just like, forget about the past episode. Whatever they're talking about here is not, doesn't refer to the prior episode.
So you are thinking too much like a modern day television viewer. This is whatever happened in the previous episode. Does not matter. It was nearly completely reset every time. So there is no reference to what happened in the previous episode, which is apparently.
But they do refer to, we just finished an exhausting mission. So we just never get to see that.
We don't see that mission. They do a lot of things out there in space. They're, you know, check it out. New life and new civilizations boldly going and so forth. But yeah, there is a lot of references to things that we as viewers never see, but they have gone off and done exciting things that we have not seen that are probably too expensive and they couldn't do. But so yeah, they say, okay, fine. And the other thing to mention in this episode is if you're a big fan of Sulu, you can skip this episode because Sulu is not in it.
That was a question I had written down in my notes. Yeah. Where the heck is Sulu? Who is that really long-armed helmsman whose right arm is always halfway off the camera because he's reaching for something underneath the table all the time?
That is the fill-in for Sulu because George Takei was off filming something else, and so he was unavailable for this episode. So they just...
Because I was like, did I miss something? Did Sulu not come in until later in the series, or did he leave partway through? And I guess he just missed this one episode.
He missed this episode. Chekhov didn't come in until the second season, but we have Chekhov here. He doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't do a whole lot, but he's here. He scans and says, "Oh, FYI, the system we're going to is dead." Kirk is like,
speaking of the crew here. So you know, I haven't seen a TOS episode in forever, and I know these are like the remastered ones I watched on Paramount Plus or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I was struck by many things that I mean, obviously I saw when I was a kid, but didn't take note of. The first is that in the opening credits. You get William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. Mm-hmm. Those are the names you get to see in that order.
Holy Trinity.
Right? And that's it. Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry obviously comes first. Big Gene Roddenberry, credit by Gene Roddenberry, just so you know that.
He's very modest.
Shatner, Nimoy, and DeForest. And then I guess the other people get credited like in the post-credit, like after they're done and they start the episode, or maybe at the end, I forget. But that's it for the crew. And we think, you know, if you think of the ensemble crew, you think of, you know, Uhura, Sulu, Chekhov, all that. But they're forget it. They're below the line in this show. And I thought that was quite a thing. And I did miss Sulu. The other thing I noted is, I mean, again, if you'd asked me, oh yeah, no, in the original Star Trek, they wear all these, you know, 60s miniskirts, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But her skirt is so short. When she sits on a chair, she can't sit on any part of her skirt. It is too short mm-hmm. to be underneath her in any way whatsoever. It's just, it does not look like, you know, reasonable outfitting for anybody doing anything on a ship. But of course, all the other women are dressed the same way. But when I was a kid, I guess I wasn't looking at her skirt. But this time I was like, this poor woman, can we get her some clothes that cover her body?
Yeah, I think that it is always a surprise at how mini those mini skirts are. And I am not a huge aficionado of 60s television, so I don't know if that was, I assume it was the style at the time, I suppose.
Yeah, no, it was the style, but like they're short and then there's like, she might as well just be wearing a shirt. Like it's true. And because she has to sit in the chair, like she has to sit there. She's got to, they shoot her. You see her, like her whole body, you see her sitting in the chair.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good.
It is not good. And then there are people always walking around holding clipboards, getting people to sign them. And they're usually women and they're usually wearing very, very short skirts.
Mm-hmm.
Such as the duties of women on the Enterprise. They answer the phone, they're nurses, and they carry clipboards around. But it was a different time, people. The Enterprise is now hurtling towards where billions of people once lived and are now all dead, plus 400 Vulcans that no one really seems to care about, other than Spock. And what do they find there, John? They find a big hole in the universe, apparently.
This is the next question. Okay, so these are, I assume, remastered in some way for Paramount Plus. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming what I saw on the view screen is not what originally appeared in the episode.
You know, I was in the back of my mind as I watched this, because I watched the remastered version as well, I thought to myself, I bet John is going to ask me what it looked like in the original version, because it did not look like this, I'm sure. But I do not know what it did look like. I'm sure it looked a lot worse.
It's so weird, though, because like, so the planet, like they have them going by a planet. It's obvious it's a CG planet, right? Mm-hmm. I know what the planets look like, and they did not look like that back then, because I remember the planets. They look terrible. You know, 60s, yeah, whatever, TV budgets, right? The thing on the screen, the big nothingness that we're talking about, like the we would call it an anomaly in modern parlance, Star Trek. It looked just like an empty black area. I'm like, if you're going to do it in CG, can you do something? And I'm like, wait a second, maybe that's what it looked like. It was literally just an empty black area and then like some light gray and then stars. And it felt like maybe they were doing an homage to what it looked like originally, or maybe that literally is what it was like. I wish there was like a button in Paramount Plus. I look for it to say, please show me original effects, because I got to know what that nothing looked like.
Well, I am looking right now to see if I can press play and see if this is the original, because it doesn't say it's remastered. So I wonder if this is the original.
It's remastered. They fly by a CG planet.
It is. So I can now report that in the original, you ever play that game? What is that game? Asteroids on what was that console? Do you remember this console? What is it? Oh man,
Vectrex.
Yes, there you go. You know, you've played the game. So they have those white outlines because it was the laser or the light drawing on the things. So basically, it looks like one of those asteroids. It has a white outline around it and some black.
Take a screenshot and send it to me.
I will.
So they did remaster, like that. Someone did the CG for that, and they said this is going to be the enhanced, improved special effects. And what they came up with was just color it all in black and then put a little gray ring around it.
Yes, exactly. And it does not look all that threatening. It looks more threatening in the remastered version. It kind of looks like a splotch of paint fell on the view screen, and there is like a faint flashlight behind it.
So here the Enterprise encounters an anomaly in space, right? What is Kirk's move? What does he decide to do? He basically just flies straight into it.
Well, no, first he shoots a probe into it, and that probe, for some reason that they never explain, or maybe I missed, creates some kind of feedback.
They explain it kind of.
I know it's like sucking out their energy, but I didn't quite understand the noise it was making.
It was like when you go quickly through the layers where the thing is sensitive,
that's right,
it sends
right.
the big feedback thing. Mm-hmm. So like, but again, like he basically just, they see it, they get closer and closer, they fire a probe, weird stuff happens. Does he stop? Does he turn around? Does he think? No, he just keeps going, keeps going, keeps going, keeps going. And that is just totally a... Not thought through strategy that leads them straight into the giant space amoeba.
Yes. And we should keep in mind the context of this thing has already killed billions of people that they are aware of just in this one system. So you would think...
Well, they just care about the 400 Vulcans. So this, you just sent me a picture of it. This is the original?
Yep.
I think it looks better than the remastered.
Oh, you take that remastered. I'm pretty sure that's the original. Maybe it isn't. Now that I'm looking at
it, I think
it
looks
remastered.
Better. I think it looks more, well, whatever. It's I do also enjoy the fact that the view screen is so clearly like a just a like a like a movie screen set. It looks like someone's home theater setup, right? And it's like recessed in. It is. Yeah.
Well, you know, they didn't have a huge budget. They did what they could.
Yeah. So this thing is like they go straight into it, but during the whole thing, like, well, so there's a lot of people going down in this episode. When Spock feels the 400 Vulcans die, he feels faint. Mm-hmm. That gives us an opportunity to see how incredibly incompetent McCoy is as a doctor, because he brings Spock into med bay and checks him out or whatever, and he's like, oh, as far as I can tell, you're fine. You know, not that I can tell with these crazy Vulcan readings, like he's a member of your crew. It's like, I don't know anything about Vulcan biology or how they're supposed to work or what their temperature should be or how many internal organs they have. It's like, it's literally your job to be the doctor for the crew. And he's like, but Vulcans, whatever. Like, I can't make heads or tails of this anyway. It seems like you're fine. So he's terrible. But then for the rest of the episode, since it's sucking the energy out of people, everybody's fainting. Everybody's feeling, you know, they're woozy. They're going down left and right. Doesn't matter who they're just constantly. And McCoy's solution, of course, is the, you know, what it works for these housewives. Stimulants for everybody.
That's right. He's just shooting up everybody with his stimulants. And he says, you know, shouldn't get addicted to these things, but in a pinch, let's shoot you up.
That's right. It's like they'll catch up with you eventually. It's the sage wisdom. Yes, everyone knows stimulants will catch up with you eventually. Anyway, stimulants for everybody.
Yeah, I did think so. The Spock McCoy relationship is always been an interesting one, and certainly in this episode, for me, it is on kind of a razor's edge, right? Of Spock can be a little needling, and so that's fine. But McCoy can just be a racist, and that seems, or a speciesist, and that just seems worse.
But Spock is also kind of emo in this one. Oh, we'll get to it in a little bit. He's like,
he's a little sad.
He wants to be friends, and he's sad about how McCoy is evil.
Well, aren't we all? It is true. This is an interesting Spock episode because, well, we'll get to it. So, yeah, Kirk basically has, well, and this is the other thing. So, Kirk gets increasingly annoyed with Spock because Spock does not instantaneously know everything about this brand new phenomena that they are encountering for the first time.
I mean, Kirk is a bad boss in the best of times, but this episode, really, he's like the very worst boss who, like, will never do, or captain of a ship, or like, you know, well, he is a captain, I guess. Like anything, like he'll never do anything to help the situation, but is very angry that everyone around him isn't solving his problem for him, right?
What
do you mean you can't tell me? What do you mean you don't know? You have to give me some information. Can you just guess? Can you do something? What about you? Can you do something? It's like, we're all in the same situation, dude. Like, you just yelling at everybody saying, why can't you tell me what to do or what the situation is? How is it that there's unknowns? I you know, it's like, that's not going to help. Like, just, can't you just guess? Can't you just tell me something? Can't you just... Oh, he was so annoying. I would have smacked him so long ago. We have had too many bosses like this.
Oh, man. And so one of the things that Captain Kirk, I think, is pretty good at is inspiring people to do the ludicrous things that he wants them to do. In this episode, I feel like he's not even good at that, because later on, he goes on the ship intercom, basically to give a pep talk, and his pep talk includes the line that our orders don't say stay alive.
Yeah, like, we should add that to the orders.
That's right. It's maybe an oversight, Captain Kirk. I think maybe it's assumed that we should stay alive.
I thought that was somewhat inspirational. So look, it's our job is, I mean, I feel like this is something to, let's get political for a second, if we can. We already talked about butts.
Yes,
right?
That's the entryway to politics. It's
something that our proud police officers could benefit from. The job of police officers is not to preserve police officer lives at all costs. In theory, they're supposed to be protecting and serving. Practice, not so much. So here he's basically gives that line. He says, look, our job is not to just do whatever we can to keep ourselves safe. So we're supposed to, you know, seek out new life and new civilizations, boldly go, blah, 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 blah. I felt like it was somewhat inspirational. I mean, you know,
he does end it with do your jobs, carry on. I was like,
yeah, I mean, it's the right, because I think he's addressing this issue is like, we thought we were going for R&R. It's a typical, you know, military thing. Oh, we were going for R&R. We got diverted.
You're tired.
And here we are in this dangerous situation. But it's not our job to just like run away and play it safe. We're supposed to figure this stuff out. So buck up, everybody.
All right. Well, I'm still not convinced, but I could see a little bit more of that. But also, most of the crew is dying at this point. Well, everyone is dying, right? Because McCoy has figured out.
I mean, we're all
out,
dying, Scott.
That is true. I did write that down.
It just depends on the speed. I do like the technology. It's kind of like the same to bring Star Wars into it that, you know, Anakin's mother died of just like, she died of dying. Like everyone, we have these, we can't tell
monitors.
Anything about this crazy Vulcan biology, but just FYI, we have enough sensors to know that essentially everyone on this ship is dying like way faster than before.
Everybody else is humans, though, so that's McCoy's specialty.
He knows how fast you're dying. He's got a graph that just shows how fast is everyone on the ship dying. He's like, that's whoa, right. That looks bad. Mm-hmm. We're all dying super fast now.
He brings it up on his little clipboard there every once in a while just to check, and
yep,
he realizes
still dying real fast.
Ooh, this is no good. And that's true. So the bad thing here is that it's sucking all the energy out of the things that are around them, and also all of their life force is being sucked out. So people explains why everyone's fainting, and why. You know, things are bad and they can't get out, which leads us to another thing where they're trying to use their engines to kind of basically pop out of this thing that Kirk has forced them into.
That before you flew straight into it, dude.
Well, and so they go full ahead and it pushes them further out or something like that. No, they go reverse.
Yeah,
they reverse.
They try to back out and the reverse happens. They don't really, like this, in a more modern incarnation of this, they would have played off this type of stuff more, like the puzzle solving. Like, oh, there's something weird. The normal rules don't apply here. They try to back out and it doesn't work. It seems like it's like opposite day. And so they come up with a strategy of like, well, what if we try to go forward? That'll maybe make us go out. But ends up that doesn't actually work because they do try to go forward. And the best they can do, expending all the ship's power, is to basically stay stationary, which is better than nothing.
That's true.
But that just drains their power even faster. This is a Scotty, I need more power heavy episode. Not that he doesn't do this all the time, but his literal only job this episode is to just provide increasing amounts of power by, I don't know, pushing buttons or whatever it is that he does down there to give power.
Well, they run around and they slide some things as well. And the thing that I found so funny about this is that Spock basically says, well, logic dictates if we went backwards and we went forwards, we should go forwards and we'll go backwards. And Scotty is like, what? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I was like, what? That seems to make.
I mean, it doesn't actually make any kind of sense.
It doesn't make
like,
any sense. But given what's happened, the empirical data seems to suggest that hypothesis is not bad.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. It depends on how close they are to the thing. If going forward, because I think at this point, like even Spock earlier had said, like, it's not just a region that we're in. There is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's got, there's an entity or whatever. Like, and so that entity could be doing all sorts of shenanigans. Like if it sees, it's like, if you go backwards and it pulls you forward, but you go forward, it'd be like, oh, sure, I'll just totally let you go forward. So that might not have worked out. But it turns out the thing is not particularly bright. So it's not a big deal. But they didn't know that at this point.
They
so,
did not.
Yeah, they're trying a bunch of stuff.
And I did like they very briefly say, oh, no, the Intrepid was destroyed by this and they probably tried everything that we're trying. So maybe we should do something different.
No, but then they're like, that was just a bunch of Vulcans. They're dummies. Like basically, I mean, it is a fairly Star Trek point of like if you get a bunch of people on a ship and all think the same way, because in the racist world of Star Trek, all Vulcans think the same way.
True.
Then They don't have a diversity of opinion about things they might do, so they might not have thought of something. And in general, Star Trek is very adamant about the fact that Kirk will do things that other people would not think of trying. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what keeps him alive, right? So I think it is reasonable to assume, oh, the other ships died, but they didn't have Kirk, and we'll do all sorts of wacky stuff. You know, that's his MO.
That's basically what happens. Spock says something about how Vulcans don't have a history of like being murdered or something like that. So they weren't ready for death. And so they were astonished instead of surprised. I don't know. It was
a situation they weren't prepared for, and it didn't make any sense, logically speaking. So they're right up to the moment of their death. They never expected to die because, you know, things should go according to how they think they should go. When they didn't go that way either, you know, their last thought was of astonishment. Like, I can't believe this. It didn't work out the way I thought it would, which, you know, giving the little monologues to give a glimpse into, you know, the Vulcan mindset is interesting. And I don't know how, I mean, obviously in the movies and all the later things that I'm much more familiar with, they lean way more heavily into Spock's dual parentage, that he's half human, right? But the show definitely, it doesn't like voice that. But here he is explaining to humans about what Vulcans must have thought of this. But the reason he's able to explain that to humans, and the reason he gets all emo about McCoy later or whatever, is because he himself is half human. So I think they do a good job of having his character straddle the line between those two worlds, rather than being straight up Vulcan all the time.
I agree. And I think that's why Spock is, some might argue, and I might be one of those people, the greatest Star Trek character ever, because of his makeup of kind of, you know, his reaction to being half human, half Vulcan, is trying to be the most Vulcan he can be, and yet still being somewhat rejected by his peers. But they don't really – that's for later. That's other Star Trek stuff where that comes in.
And later we had Data.
And later we had Data, who's very similar, and Worf is a little bit of that too. And Odo, there's a lot of echoing of Spock throughout Star Trek. No notion of conquering is the thing I thought. So Vulcans have no notion of conquering because their history does not have any conquering.
I feel like saying, yeah, their whole planet's eventually going to get blown up, so watch for that.
Oh, man, all that interesting interior design lost forever.
Yeah. So speaking of interiors, like this, I know this is a trope of the original series and I'm very familiar with it, but this episode seemed to have a lot of it. Is there a term of art for the people flopping all over the sets?
I'm sure there is, but I noticed it as well. And some of them, there was one particular scene, I don't remember which shaky cam, shaky Enterprise section it was, but one guy like flips over the handrail very dramatically.
Going all out this episode. There's like seven scenes of crew members flopping all over the place, and they just like pick a person and watch them. Like the things these people do are so ridiculous. Like they're just not particularly convincing, and they're just all over the place. And you know, it's like, I know it's a trope and occasionally have, but it's like, people, seatbelts. Like, I know it is like talking about no railings in Star Wars. I realize it's such a cliche, but when you see how heavily they go into it in this particular episode, they do it so much you just can't help but think, like, it's the 60s. I think seatbelts in cars are just coming out. Like, it just, at the very least, when you know you're intentionally doing a maneuver that's going to cause this to happen, like,
brace yourself.
Sit on the floor. Like, I don't know. Do something. But they're all just standing there holding a martini glass. And they're like, okay, ready, fire the thrusters. Like, whoa. Of course. Like, they don't have inertial dampeners. I get it. But
rearrange my crystal revolver. Oh, no.
They're just, any one of these scenes, they're just, you know, there's so many people. I think they are like little skits with each other of like, okay, I'm going to do this and you're going to do that. And you're going to fall in my lap.
And it's just, and I don't know if you've seen this before, and I'll put a link in the show notes. But there is someone who has done image stabilization
some of these scenes,
And it is very funny because
that's a thing. The thing about this episode, has a lot of ones where the camera does not shake enough, and you get that vibe of the stabilized ones because you see how what they're actually doing. Like, again, because they're not really synchronized. Like the director's trying to go, okay, everyone go to the left, and saying to make people, but they're not actually synchronized. There's always like the one kid in the corner, like in the school dance, who's not doing it the right way. The one guy flops in the wrong direction. It is ridiculous. I mean, it's inconsequential in this one. And also, this is before not before, but I guess like they don't have the budget for the trademark sparks from the consoles, which is another, which I think helps to hide the dives, the stage dives or whatever they're doing, you know, the sparks from the consoles, everything on the Enterprise, sparks fly from it when anything bad happens to the ship. I kind of miss that.
Yeah, we just get people throwing themselves over handrails, but at least they have handrails, unlike Star Wars.
Yeah, and they tend not to ruin the sets. Like, they basically, they shake around and everything, and everyone gets up, and they dust themselves off, and they're okay.
Then they sit back down and do their jobs, because their job is not to stay alive, John. It is to kill this amoeba, because they figure out they have pierced the dark, like, the final layer, and they have found in the middle of this dark energy-sucking Easter egg, I guess, is an 11,000 mile long single-celled creature.
With a big, like, black sesame seed in it? Like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
They didn't really describe, I mean, obviously this is the revised special effects, but they never mentioned it in the script. So I don't know when the person who did the graphics for this said, you know what? This amoeba is going to have a big chunk of coal shoved in it. So.
Well, they were like, why not? Who cares? And it is generating this thing, and they have to figure out what to do with it. I think they very quickly decide that they should kill it, because they come to the hypothesis that it is basically invading our universe or galaxy. I don't remember which order of magnitude they decided on. And it is, they find out later, that it's gathering all this energy. And it has just enough, because of chromosomes or something, to split. So it's about to reproduce itself. And they have to stop it before it does that. I don't really understand. I mean, it could be scientifically correct, but I don't understand how they got
do,
to that.
They do a little bit of the period appropriate, like, what if we're all just a cell in the toenail of a giant man kind of thing. Because they're like, if this is a cell, and if this divides, then there'll be two, then four, then, you know, like, eventually their idea is that this one single cell will divide into, I don't know, a galaxy scale human or something. And then we, the Enterprise, would be like a germ inside it. Kind of like
true.
The Fantastic Voyage or Inner Space, which had not yet been made. and that's their like, whoa, man, you ever think of that, man? And then they continue with the episode.
And then they say, we should kill it. So yeah,
the prime directive, shmime directive.
But they need to know more about it. They need to get closer to plant whatever things they're going to do. So, basically someone has to go on a shuttlecraft, and see if they can poke around. And so McCoy, super eager, because he's like, this is like the most amazing scientific discovery.
He knows all about cells.
And he does. He doesn't know about Vulcans, but he knows about cells. And so he's super excited. He's got his equipment all ready. And Spock is like, well, I should go because I'm Spock.
I'm way smarter than you.
And basically, I know how to use all the same equipment as McCoy, and I have the added bonus of being smart.
And also, they lean a little bit heavily on the idea that Vulcans are genetically have basically a higher constitution score in D&D parlance than humans.
It's true. And now this is where Captain Kirk has to make the tough decision to choose between his two friends and his two co-workers and decide, which one do I send to shore death? Do I send my doctor? Do I send my science officer? And he decides to tell them in a super jerky way.
He does it like a reality show. He's way ahead of his time. You know, where the reality show where they want it, they wait and then they say a contestant's name and the contestant's heart drops, but they don't know if that one is the winner or the loser. He does that.
He does. He's like, I'm sorry, Mr. Spock. And then McCoy's like, woohoo, I'll go get my equipment.
No, he says, McCoy, go gather your equipment for the thing. And McCoy's like, yes. And Spock's like, aw. And it's like, gather your equipment and put it in the shuttlecraft so that Spock can pilot it. Gotcha. Yeah. And I have to say, during this thing, well, first of all, I guess only top line credited people are eligible for this mission because it's just the three of them. It's like, you got a whole crew full of red shirts. Yeah. I saw one go down on the bridge earlier. Like, send them. Like,
can't trust those jerks.
Exactly. But then, so I saw the scene and I'm like, granted that I haven't seen this episode or whatever. It's like, to go to certain deaths or whatever. I was like, is it going to be a thing where Kirk just goes? Because I don't know if this was done heavily in TOS, but many even modern shows will have like, okay, we've got a crew of 100 people and someone needs to do something dangerous. How about the captain? It's like if we were going to kill Bin Laden and Obama went on the mission, right? That's about how much sense it makes to have the captain go in the shuttlecraft and do the incredible dangerous things. Like, you're the freaking captain. That's not your job. That's what you have a crew for, right? So I thought, is he going to go himself or whatever? But no, he's not even going to go himself. He's just going to make a call. He's going to be like, I have to choose between these two friends of mine. It's so difficult. Should I go myself? No, I'll just pick one.
So he hands Mr. Spock the rose, and Mr. Spock goes into the shuttlecraft to figure out how to kill this giant single-celled thing.
Yeah, we don't see him doing much in the shuttlecraft except for spending a lot of time on the radio, razzing McCoy, and getting busy dying. But presumably when he's off camera, he's doing science things.
He's doing, you know, science. It's boring to watch science. And so they do a lot of shorthand. And so he, I don't think he actually needs to do anything there, though, because I don't think he finds anything out, right? Because Kirk just assumes, oh, let's just shoot antimatter at it.
No, he sends back readings. Like, there is a whole thing of, like, he accomplishes his mission. And then, he ends up through the getting through the layer, and he razzes McCoy, and he's like, just FYI, you would have died from what I just went through because you're such squishy little human, which is nice of him. Mm-hmm. And then when he is dying, so we got to rewind a little bit with the scene where Kirk picks Spock to go. Spock and McCoy are left there and like, well, I guess you won. It's like, whatever. Okay. It's like, well, you know, fine, whatever, go. And then what do you want me to say? And Spock's like, well, you could wish me luck. And McCoy doesn't say anything. And Spock leaves. But then after Spock leaves the room, McCoy says, good luck. But then as Spock is dying, or ostensibly dying in the shuttlecraft, I actually didn't think Spock would die, just FYI.
What?
as he's dying in the shuttlecraft, Spock whispers to himself, McCoy, you should have wished me good luck. He's still sad about, he wanted McCoy to wish him good luck, and he's sad that McCoy didn't wish him good luck. He's so emo, he's so sad, he so wants to be friends with McCoy, even though McCoy is so mean to him.
Well, and that's the thing, because I think McCoy and Spock are friends. Well, I know they are. And they just have this weird borderline abusive relationship with each other where they just say horrible things to one another for I don't know why, just because.
I mean, Spock is competitive with McCoy and wants to show that he is superior because of his Vulcanness, and McCoy is racist.
well, that's true. And I think they're probably also competing over Kirk, right? Because they both want to be Jim's best friend. And
well, yeah, you said that Spock and McCoy are friends, but I feel like the only thing we have on the record is that James T. Kirk has been and always will be Spock's friend. And McCoy, I don't know, I guess he likes him.
Well, McCoy got his entire essence uploaded into his head.
That.
They spoilers
have that.
For...
They have that going for them.
So, you know, they have a complicated relationship is what I'm saying. And this episode is one fine example of the very complicated relationship they have throughout it. Because they say horrible things to each other and then they say nice things to each other. It's very confusing.
Yeah, and the whole ship, like, so eventually, you know, they get the information back and they do the thing, whatever. And they're basically trying to escape in a sequence that would have been much more exciting if they had the effects budget to show a ship trying to escape from things, which is a thing they'll do later in later decades with the franchise. But then they're like, oh, and by the way, on our way out, hey, look, there's Spock and he's not dead. Let's divert a whole bunch of the power, the precious power of the ship. Let's divert power to get some tractor beams on that to pull the shuttlecraft back. It's basically like risking the entire ship just to get Spock back. And I'm like, if Spock was that important, don't send him in the shuttlecraft. But anyway, like, they have to get Spock back because he's the second credited person on the show.
That's true. And they do. The tractor beams are activated. Everybody makes it out alive. And the episode ends with one of the oddest things, I think, it doesn't matter, but they have just gone through this traumatic experience. Spock is back on the ship. They are flying, one assumes, back to the starbase to, you know, repair the ship and maybe get some R&R. And like literally a minute after they have rescued Spock, someone comes up to Captain Kirk and has him sign something. And I thought, what does he need? What is so important that he needs to sign it this second?
Being a captain is real important. Well, he's got important captainly duties to do. And then so they do the thing, which is, you know, television formula or whatever. In the beginning, they had him do his double entendre horn dog thing of like, I forget what the line was, but I'm going to some rest and relaxation, lying down with. On something, or I don't know, they do some double entendre thing. They did the exact same thing at the end. He's like, I was horny at the beginning of this episode and I'm horny at the end, and in the middle I killed an amoeba.
It's really, I mean, that's the start and end of Star Trek, I think, is sums it up perfectly. So speaking of summing up, what did you think of this episode of the original series, John?
I mean, I think it's a couple things. So first, you know, watching TOS as an adult, which I don't think I've really done, I mostly watched it since I was a kid, makes me really appreciate the what I have to chalk up to the increased talent of the directors that would later wrangle these actors in the movies, because the Spock Kirk McCoy relationship, obviously, you know, it is established in the series, but when you get those characters in any of the motion pictures, their acting is so much better. Like, the writing is better, the acting is better, and I chalk that up mostly to the directing, because I don't think between TOS and, like, the motion picture and stuff, that these actors suddenly became seven times as good, but their performances of this exact dynamic, this exact character dynamic, is, in fact, seven times better, because presumably they had a director, and maybe also a writer, who had them in front of the camera and say, okay, do it, until they eventually got a take that was reasonable. But the bones of it are all here, huh? See what I did there? Mm. So I appreciated seeing that. I did enjoy seeing, like I said, the prototype for the "we have encountered an anomaly in space and have to wrangle with it." And I'm sure there are many other TOS episodes that are like this, but it became such a formula that would be expanded upon later. And also watching TOS, I was struck by how much the Next Generation has dominated my view of what Star Trek is. Despite the fact that, of course, I knew TOS was first and I saw it first. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I saw tons and tons of episodes or whatever. I didn't realize how much Next Gen had, like, which I also didn't watch religiously, but saw tons of because it was on TV all the time, how much that informed my thought of, like, what Star Trek is, because this is less utopian sci-fi, prime directive, we have no money, racist, generally not approved of, like, women aren't in short skirts. the sci-fi stories are going to be complicated. The plots are going to be like, they would take this formula and run with it and modernize it and have episodes that are much more intricate with much more interesting. Like, they would have ones that tie into character things in their past, and they would have just straight up sci-fi ones where we got to figure out this puzzle creature, setting aside the Q episodes, which I think we've talked about before, which is a whole other subgenre that is similar. We're in a ship, we're driving around, weird stuff happens. Mm-hmm. Like, going back to the original, you see the seeds of all of that, but you realize, boy, they're really going to expand upon this in the future. They're going to leave behind the weird stuff and the kind of cringy stuff. They're going to leave behind the sweaty foreheads and they still have the jumpsuits, but they'll be a little bit less shiny. And they'll, move on from that. But I thought this, I mean, it's not the best episode, but it was comforting for me to watch. And it, like, Deep Space Nine was weird for me to watch because that is not like, this is mainline TOS, TNG. Like, that's what I'm very familiar with. Deep Space Nine, I was like, well, this is a different kind of show. We get different characters and they don't fit into those molds and it's a different setting and they're not flying around in a ship all the time. Right. This is like, oh, the egg form. This is the egg form of the Star Trek that I know.
I
recognize
this.
And an egg would hatch, and then a dinosaur would eventually come out, and then a bigger dinosaur would eat that dinosaur, and it would just go on and on. And it's kind of nice to go back to the egg and go, look at them on their little carpets with their little velour vests and stuff, looking at their view screen, dealing with an anomaly. They don't even know enough to call it an anomaly yet. Isn't that adorable? But, aww. I just love seeing, like, the young actors. Boy, young Scotty, what a hunk, right? And Kirk doing his Kirkiest stuff, and
yes.
McCoy looking like a cranky little whiner instead of like the crusty old man that he was. It kind of makes me appreciate later Star Trek.
I agree. And every time I go back to the original series, especially the remastered ones, I am impressed at how good, like, they tried their best with remastering the special effects. And of course, the special effects are far better than they were in the original. But they are also, they were done maybe, I don't even remember when. It must have been, 2007. So it's been a while since the remastered special effects have been done. But the film itself, the image of it is amazingly clear.
You can see that sweat real clearly.
That's the downside to it, but it looks really good. And I'm always, you mentioned the costumes or the velour, and I just, every time I see an original series episode, I'm just tickled by the costumes, just because they are, especially whenever Kirk is wearing some weird variant of his uniform, which he is in this episode. He's wearing his green
weird kind of vesty
thing. Yeah, so that always amuses me. But I'll agree with you. This is not this is not a bad episode of the original series. I felt it had a little, it dragged a little bit for me in the middle, but overall, I enjoyed it. And, you know, if you're craving to watch an amoeba get destroyed by a starship, there are worse options than the immunity syndrome.
Yeah, I think they, like, to the credit of the script, there, every little thing that we mentioned that's in here, the various scenes with the three of them, the dynamic between them, even the mentioning of, like, what if this were a cell in the toenail of a giant and this thing grows, like, they hit all the things they have to hit in mm-hmm. there. Like, we're confused by this anomaly, let's try this, we need more power from Scotty, it's illogical, what did the Vulcans think? Like, there's a lot in this. There's a lot of, it's not just, like, a very rote, boring, you know, journey from point A to point B. It's just that when they stop off at each one of those things, it's a sentence or two, and it's not a particularly clever sentence or two, and it's not dwelled on. But like, but this is just one episode in a longer series that goes through. So this is not a distinguished episode, but even within the realm of just like, there are modern TV shows that I watch that don't put in the work that they tried to put into the script to have all these different elements. Character elements, mm-hmm. character development, sci-fi things, mm-hmm. You know, tension of decision making. Like, everybody gets to do something for one or two sentences or one or two moments. And I think the acting performances are not great in many places here. Well, again, especially the major actors are way better later. But that's why I think of this as like an egg, or like a high school production of what would later become a big thing. But I give it lots of credit for having all the pieces. That they're just not, it's not particularly well executed, because it's not, you know, it's not a standout episode of the show, but I'm surprised at how watchable I found it, considering just how incredibly old it is. And, you know, like, in many ways I found it more, like I said, more comforting and relaxing and familiar to watch than Deep Space Nine.
Well, and I can totally understand that, because Deep Space Nine is trying to do something very different than The Next Generation, which was trying to do something very similar to the original series. So that makes complete sense to me. But one thing that I find quite comforting is talking to you, John. So thank you so much for joining me and talking about Star Trek.
I'm glad I got to graduate to the mainline series. As long as I don't have to watch Enterprise next episode, I think everything will keep looking up.
I make no promises.